From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed.
Whenever I played here, I felt like I had unbelievable power and nobody could stop me.
You can't say enough about Moon Jung-Lee, an All-American. She is one of the keys outside.
She's a triple threat. She can shoot the ball from the perimeter, take it to the basket strong, and she's an excellent passer.
An inside, a great power game.
She was the quintessential person that let her game do her talking.
Then the Indians on the press.
Moon Jung's going to be guarded closely all night long.
You didn't know if she's going to shoot it or she's going to pass it. All you knew, you just had to have your hand up. She could do some things not many people could do back in that time.
Nice pass there by Moon Jung-Lee. Nicely executed play.
She could have been a superstar in the WNBA because she was so before her time.
You just heard an excerpt from the film E.J. Lee, All-American. It's a documentary in process, and it's the first film directed by Jason Rhee. Ung Jung-Lee, known as E.J., was a legend in Louisiana basketball in the 1980s. In fact, she was dubbed, and I quote, the Korean Magic Johnson of NCAA women's basketball. Despite a remarkable career and decades of work as an assistant coach, she had never been able to get a position as a head coach on the college level. Jason Rhee, a Korean-American who grew up playing basketball, came across her story in 2020. He saw that it would have resonance with Asian Americans and the treatment they often receive in the workplace, and female athletes, the sisterhood they share, and the limits placed on them. And he wanted to give EJ's story a wide audience. He reached out to her and discovered EJ was coaching a high school basketball team. EJ and Jason clicked, and he began documenting her journey. And timing is everything, because in 2022, at the age of 60, E.J. Lee began as head coach of women's basketball at Sewell Ross State University in Texas. And Jason was there to document her first year. I spoke with Jason Rhee recently. Here's our conversation. You're in the midst of making a documentary called E.J. Lee, All-American. Give us a thumbnail sketch about E.J. and your film to set the stage.
E.J. Lee is a visionary Louisiana legend, former basketball player who had a remarkable career in the NCAA during the 1980s. And E.J. is so far ahead of her time in terms of female basketball player. And my documentary is covering how not only her remarkable feats back in the 80s, but her current day journey as a 60-year-old head coach in a male-dominated field, and how she's been able to persevere through microaggressions, discrimination, and still is committed to the game that she's dedicated her entire life to.
Her stats are remarkable. Share what she achieved as a college player.
E.J. Lee is a two-time All-American. She's a four-time Southland Conference Player of the Year, one of five men or women in the NCAA history to accomplish this achievement. And she's a Louisiana Hall of Famer, one of seven women inducted in history. EJ finished her college career with a record of 102 wins and 15 losses, an astonishing record.
I have seen footage of her play and my jaw was on the floor. Yeah. How would you describe her playing?
Oh, absolutely electric. She was doing behind-the-back passes, no-look assists, step-back jumpers, and these are all skills that are very common in today's modern game, but they were practically unheard of back when she was playing in the 80s. And when I read up on the history of EJ and that Final Four team of Northeast Louisiana University, thousands of people lined up to witness EJ and her team put on a show. And EJ did so with tremendous skill, tremendous showmanship and intensity.
So she was a real sports celebrity in Louisiana.
Yes, she was. I've had the pleasure of being in her hometown of Monroe, Louisiana. And even to this day, 40 years after she had played in college, there are people that still stop her and go, I remember my dad or my mom threw us in a car and we traveled to that rival game against Louisiana Tech. And just to think of the women's game selling out back then, doing more numbers than the men's game at the time, is really unbelievable.
Now, EJ was born in Korea, in South Korea. When did she come to the United States and what precipitated her coming?
She first began her love for basketball in Kimje, South Korea, a small rural town. And then eventually she moved with her family to Seoul, where she became one of the top high school basketball prospects. She eventually got a full scholarship ride to Northeast Louisiana University, which is now known as University of Louisiana Monroe, in 1982. And she immigrated here to America, knowing barely any English, with a suitcase and two dictionaries in hand, just in case she lost one dictionary.
And no family.
And absolutely no family.
ULM is a rural school. It's not in the middle of a city.
No, not at all.
Yeah, so how was that adjustment for her?
It was extremely difficult. Speaking with her and how she reminisces about the past, there's barely any Asian people, let alone Korean people. EJ was so homesick. She wanted to go home. She didn't know the language or the culture very much. But she did have this coach, this head coach named Linda Harper, who was essentially a mom to her.
What did she do once she graduated? She had this fantastic four-year career at the university. But then what options were open to her once she left college basketball?
This was before the WNBA era. And at that time, EJ had just made it to the Final Four, one of the biggest stages of basketball. And the only path to continue her basketball career was to play overseas. And eventually she played for Sweden and Italy, where she received MVP honors. But her career was cut off short after a contract dispute with one of the countries. And she eventually immigrated back to America, where she started her family and then her coaching career.
And her coaching career is not without challenges. She was always relegated to being an assistant coach.
Correct. Yeah. She was climbing up that coaching ladder. She was an assistant, was a recruiter, a longtime recruiter that was constantly on the road trying to recruit players for university. And she just put her head down and kept on working and working and working for that one opportunity that many basketball coaches dream of, which is to become the head coach of a college basketball program. And there was this dream of one day taking over that alma mater program, the program that she put on the map, that she led to the Final Four. And she always had that dream of winning the championship, something that she never was able to do as a player.
And just to be clear, she worked at her alma mater, ULM, as an assistant coach for years.
Correct.
20 years?
For 20 plus years, and eventually she was promoted to be the associate head coach, which is right below the head coaching role. Coach EJ, as many Asian Americans do in our workplace, they put their head down and they just work as hard as possible, one day hoping for that opportunity to get that leadership role that they dream of. And like many Asian Americans, EJ faced this bamboo ceiling. She could only go so far in the coaching ranks. She was constantly criticized for not being able to speak proper English because of her accent. But if anyone who sat down with her could see the tremendous passion and the commitment she had to not only the game, but to her players and the community. So it was truly tragic that she wasn't able to get that opportunity.
Until 2022, when she was 60.
Exactly.
What happened?
So after about 300 to 400 job applications, throughout her 30-plus year coaching career, these applications that she would apply to colleges all across the country, She was constantly rejected. She barely heard back from anybody. But if you look at her resume, an All-American, four-time conference player of the year, Louisiana Hall of Famer, you would think that she would get the opportunity, but she was unable to. Until back in August 2022, a small Division III program in West Texas of Sol Ross State University took a chance on EJ. And that is when she received her first college head coaching job opportunity.
What drew you to the story of EJ Lee? How did you find out about her? Had you always known about her? Was it a discovery on your part?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a discovery. It was a truly profound discovery. Just to share a little bit about my journey that led to this moment, I have actually a background in comedy and in writing. And I was a writer's assistant for The Onion at the time. I was reading a ton of politics and just these terrible news that's just happening in our country all the time. And there was this disconnect that I felt from my personal childhood, my personal interests, my own identity as an Asian American. And I felt this longing to search deeper into that background. At that time, my mom had passed away from COVID after being in hospice care at the end of 2020. And then a month later, I'm writing about my time playing in Korean church basketball leagues when I discover the highlights of EJ Lee. And here is this woman who is an immigrant, a single mother, just like my own mother. And I felt like the universe, God, whatever the powers that may be, opened this story up to me, and I just had to take it and run. This documentary field is something that's very new to me and is a huge learning experience. But I knew that after speaking to EJ, that I had to pursue this story no matter what.
I'm curious, so you discover EJ Lee. How do you make contact with her? Was it a cold call? Did you find somebody you might have known in common? How did you reach out and pitch?
I sat on EJ's email address for a few weeks. I was nervous. I was scared. Why would this legend want to speak to me? I didn't know what to do. And at that time, I was still heavily grieving my mom's death. But eventually, I reached out through email, cold call email. She responded pretty quickly. And what I realized after a Zoom session, several Zoom sessions, that she was also grieving. She was going through a difficult time in her career where she wasn't sure what was in store for her anymore, if it was the end for her. And I think because of what I was going through in my personal life, that I was able to develop an understanding, compassion, and just being a person that could just listen. I think there's not been many people who could just listen. And I'm honored to be one of the few people in her life who are able to hear EJ and her difficulties and her struggles.
You also share a love of basketball. It was important to you when you were a kid. You grew up playing basketball.
Right. Basketball was an anchor for me. It was just me and my single mother. She was an undocumented immigrant, and we moved around all throughout the country. I was born in Oklahoma City. I grew up in Dallas and Houston, Colorado, spent a little bit of time in New York, and eventually ended up in Illinois. And I was a caretaker early on in my childhood. And throughout all the turbulent childhood, the chaos of my childhood, basketball was where I could let loose, make friends in these different locations, these different homes that I found myself in. It allowed me to express myself and get my frustrations out. Basketball is more than just a game to me. It's something that has kept me out of trouble, has helped me find my way.
And your mom's own story, as you mentioned, has a lot to do with you choosing to make this film. In a way, it's a way of honoring your own mother's story, isn't it?
It is. My mom is someone who's kept a lot of her personal life to herself. I know very little of her background, of the family that I had back in Korea. And she's someone that I believe had to swallow a lot of shame and suffering and silence. While I'm greatly affected by this loss of my mom, this film was born out of grief. I found it to be a blessing to have come across EJ's story a few weeks after my mother's death. I hope I can share EJ's accomplishments, joys, and struggles, as I wish I could have done so for my own mother, and also for the many Asian Americans and Asian immigrants who have had similar experiences as EJ. This is not a singular experience that EJ has gone through. This is a similar theme that our community has experienced and now are speaking out about.
This film is certainly about EJ and basketball, but it's also exploring a number of issues. Why don't you recount some of the issues you are exploring through this film?
One of my main intentions for EJ Lee All-American in this documentary film is to bring more of a spotlight onto women's basketball, especially at the Division III level. These young women that EJ is leading at Sol Ross State University, they don't have athletic scholarships. So they're truly there for the love of the game. In my time covering this past season, I was interested in exploring the sisterhood, the bond that these young women share with one another. And that was truly evident. And it's very evident in EJ's past team at Northeast Louisiana University. That sisterhood of small town women shocked the world back in 1985. And I am trying to cover that kinship as well in this present day journey. I'm also discovering through EJ's personal story the effects of aging in the workplace. I believe older women are often relegated to the outskirts of society or pushed out of jobs. And that was the case for EJ up until this most recent position. So I'm interested in exploring that theme, as well as the Asian American experience. A large number of our community suffers in silence, suffers in shame. And that is largely the case for me as well, up until the last few years, is keeping all this shame and messy feelings to myself, not wanting to expose that vulnerability. But what I found throughout this process of filmmaking, of covering EJ's career and her current day life, is that there's a lot of power in vulnerability. Many people can resonate, not just the Asian American community, but others who have faced hardships, who have been counted out. Like this documentary is truly an underdog story.
Speaking of underdogs, in the show notes for your film, you also share some shocking statistics about women basketball coaches at the college level.
Right. There's a very few number of BIPOC women coaching college teams as a head college coach. This is very, very evident in EJ's personal life, but also in the greater NCAA coaching landscape. It is a constant struggle for women of color, of BIPOC coaches, to get that fair shot, especially Asian American and Hispanic coaches.
Well, EJ, after 20-something years as an assistant, finally did get her shot as head coach of a college team just last year in 2022. How has it been for her?
Oh, it's been phenomenal. It hasn't been without its ups and downs, I do have to say. I've had the pleasure of covering her first season, and I just came back from 2.5 months on the road in Texas. And I was able to embed myself in this women's basketball program in this community of Alpine, Texas. And EJ did what she knew she could do for 30 years. She led her team to the best winning record in school history during the NCAA era. They had the most conference wins. 5 players received all conference honors. And she beat teams for the first time in history. It was truly phenomenal to be there on the ground floor and watch her learn how to take on this new role, work with her players, who she has many differences with in terms of just the generational divide, the cultural differences. That community is majority Hispanic, and it's actually a majority Hispanic women's basketball team. So to watch an older female Asian American coach lead a majority Hispanic basketball team, it felt like a story that was made up. When has this ever happened in the history of basketball? So I knew that there was something very special happening in the moment.
I want to back up just for a moment. You had said you began at The Onion and writing comedy. You were a stand-up comic, which I think is incredibly brave. How did you then move to documentary filmmaking? What drew you to that?
It's definitely an unorthodox path into documentary filmmaking. When I was doing comedy, when I was doing comedy writing for The Onion, for stand-up, and even for several one-woman shows with my colleague, Kelly Howard, an incredible stand-up comic in Chicago. When I think back on what I was doing in comedy, I was trying to explore the messy parts of my childhood, the messy parts of life, of grief, and try to find humor in it. I feel there's such strength in finding humor in these difficult moments. And that has largely helped me throughout this documentary filmmaking process, that even though EJ and I are talking about these difficult things that have happened in her life, still there's humor in her personal life, that she's a very funny person, that she has a way of handling these hardships with such grace. So in terms of making my transition into documentary filmmaking, it's very new. It was a risk that I wasn't sure that I could do. I went to film school at DePaul University, but as a screenwriting major, I had barely picked up a camera. I really had no idea what I was doing, but what I was doing was taking a leap of faith, knowing that this story can help my community, can help many other communities. And because of that importance in the story, that's what's driven me to pursue this documentary.
So it was EJ's story that brought you to documentary filmmaking.
Correct, correct.
Wow. But how did you then begin to learn how to use a camera? I mean, I know you had a fellowship at Cartemquin. What did you learn through that?
The Cartemquin Diverse Voices and Docs Fellowship was essential to me being able to begin this journey as a doc filmmaker. That is a 6-month-long program with workshops and meetings with mentors that share every step of this documentary filmmaking journey. I was truly able to know what to expect despite not having gone through it because of this mentorship and this community of other filmmakers that are going through the same process as I was. That was largely the reason why I wanted to get into this fellowship, was this sense of community. It was extremely difficult to take a leap of faith to begin this journey, that I knew I needed people around me who have done this before, who are doing it just in the way, same way as I am doing, with equally important stories who have inspired me to keep going. And we have been able to celebrate our achievements together, commiserate in the difficulties of being an independent doc filmmaker where there's so little funding when you're first starting off. And I believe that has been essential to the success of this doc so far.
Well, now you're a 2023 Center for Asian American Media, or CAM, fellow. Tell me about that fellowship and how it can provide support for your film.
Yeah, the Center of Asian American Media has been tremendous supporters of me and this story. I'm truly honored to be. It's a program that develops Asian American documentary filmmakers by pairing us with mentors and colleagues who are on the same path as I am. My mentor is Deanne Borge-Liam, and she's already provided tremendous help on this process. To be in this community of other Asian American filmmakers, of other Asian American creatives, is something that I could not have dreamed of in my childhood. I grew up with not much exposure to Asian American in media. I didn't know that there are Asian American doc filmmakers. And to have this visibility and the support of an incredible organization like CAM has given me more inspiration to continue going on this path, to continue taking these leaps of faith in filmmaking.
I'm curious how you're telling this story, because filmmakers have lots of choices. Tell me about some of yours, because you're looking at her historical journey and you're looking at her current role as head coach.
Right. One of my favorite documentaries, which is a Cartemquin film, is Hoop Dreams. It's amazing. I remember watching that in college, just massively depressed, and it gave me so much inspiration. And like Hoop Dreams, E.J. Lee All-American, this documentary is a verite film as well.
Now, I'm going to interrupt you just for 1 second. Explain for people who might not be familiar, what does that mean, a verite film?
A verite film is essentially just following everyday life, following the lives of people. And that is difficult when you don't know what to expect. In narrative filmmaking, you have this plan, you have shot lists, you have everything ready to go, and everything in its neat little order. But in verite filmmaking, it's going with the flow of what's happening in life. You know, one day coach may be like, I gotta go take up this meeting with a president at the university. And I'm just like, can I follow you? Can I just come with you? Is that okay? And what I love about verite filmmaking is that I'm able to capture everyday life, what seems like mundane details, but says so much about a person. You're really able to develop an understanding of who a person is when you're able to be with them almost every day. So not only is this a verite film, it's also a historical film where I'll delve deep into the archives of EJ's playing career in the 1980s, going back as well to her time in Korea as a little girl who was dribbling in muddy fields. So this will be a melding of verite and archival documentary.
So far, for every minute you film, how much ends up on the screen?
I believe we filmed roughly about 300 plus hours so far over the course of the last 2 years. There will only be 90 minutes of that 300 hours.
So working with a good editor is really important.
Oh, absolutely crucial. It's crucial in doc filmmaking, especially in verite filmmaking, to work with an editor who's able to take this huge pool of what seems like a mess and make it into a narrative story. And I'm really excited to work with several editors on my team, Sam Brong, Zoe Sua Cho. As a three-headed team, we will tackle EJ's life and hopefully do our best to honor her story.
Fundraising is always a concern, and it's an ongoing concern with documentary filmmaking. How are you raising money?
For the first year when I started this documentary, I was self-funding it. I believe I poured about $30,000 of my own money into this filmmaking. At the time, I had a full-time job and a salary job where I had some money saved up, and I was able to have the privilege of doing that. But quickly that money ran out. There's this really funny story. It was February 2022. It was the end of EJ's high school basketball season. And I knew I just had to be there. I was largely not there during the high school season because of a lack of funding. But I knew I had to cover the last game. And it was a 3-day trip. I used all my money. I didn't even know if it was a smart idea to go. And one of the days, EJ and I went to her former coach's grave, Coach Linda Harper's grave. And that was a very solemn moment. And after that, we went to a casino. It was my first time ever being in a casino, and I won several thousand dollars. And that funded my trip to Korea with EJ last May. And since then, I've received independent grants from funders such as Catapult Film Fund, Southern Documentary Fund, Center for Asian American Media, and Kartemkwin that have given me the capability to cover this past season. These nonprofit organizations believe in our story, who believe in the message that I'm trying to tell with this documentary. So I'm incredibly grateful to those organizations. And the large funding sources of this film will be nonprofit institutions.
And Jason, where are you in the making of the film?
I've completed the majority of production. We hopefully have a timeline of releasing the documentary late next year, early 2025. We have a lot of footage to go through that I'm excited to with my team. And that's our next step, is to start cutting together an actual film.
And then, of course, even though you're still putting the film together, you must be thinking ahead about the festival circuit as a way of getting people to see the film and getting audiences and distributors.
Absolutely. It's like half the battle to just complete the film. The other half of the battle is getting it out there, finding a distributor, finding a place for your film to live. And I believe this film will have to have a large grassroots movement, receiving community support through community screenings, through festival circuits, and get that word of mouth out there. So to be able to share this journey so far on this podcast is a tremendous help, first off. So I really appreciate being able to do this because it will help more people know about EJ and be inspired about EJ's story. My goal is to get this out to the community, to not only Asian Americans, but to young female athletes, to young student athletes who can take from EJ's difficult path up to this point and know that they can persevere as well.
And I think that is a great place to leave it. Jason, thank you. Thank you for giving me your time. Thank you for introducing me to EJ Lee. And I wish you all the luck.
Thank you so much, Joe. Thank you again.
You're welcome. That was filmmaker Jason Ree. His documentary in progress is titled EJ Lee, All American. You can keep up with Jason and the film's progress at ejleedocumentary.com, and we'll have a link to it in our show notes. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd love to know your thoughts. Email us at artworkspod@arts.gov. And follow us wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a rating on Apple, because it helps other people who love the arts to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.